Hi, this is Dr. Mike Barnes. Thank you for joining my podcast, Beyond Addiction and Trauma, the Family Recovery Podcast. First, I want to say make an apology. I haven't done a podcast in a while, and I've been traveling a lot and speaking and training and doing all those things. So I'm back at it. Today's guest is Brennan Moore. He's an old friend. We first met back in when I was at Cedar, and he was at a treatment center in Ocala, Florida, called the Refuge. And he's an experiential therapist from Bend, Oregon. He's a really early adapter of trauma integrated addiction treatment. He and I kind of came along at the same time. He was more focusing on working with childhood trauma, and I was working with trauma in families and in the addiction world. He's a fabulous therapist. Fabulous guy, very funny guy. And so we're going to be discussing the role of experiential therapy and addiction treatment. Why is it helpful? Why is it so positive in creating insights and growth and change? Why is it's different than talk therapy and ways that it's actually more effective than talk therapy? So we'll talk about methods like EMDR, parts work, breath work, things that individuals and their family members can really begin to utilize as they're moving along their own path for recovery. So remember, you can listen to the podcast on Apple Podcasts. You can also watch the podcast on my YouTube channel, Michael Barnes, PhD, LAC, LPC. And you can also buy my book, When the Solution Becomes the Problem, Helping Families Struggling with Addiction and Trauma, on my website, drmikebarnes.com. Dr. period Mike, Mike, Barnes, Barnes, dot com. And books can be purchased both in paperback and in electronic versions. So let's get on with the podcast. So guest today is Brennan Moore. Brennan and I have known each other for a really long time, and I think we were just talking that we met when I was still back at my Cedar days, and you were in Ocala, Florida, at the Refuge, and I remember being so impressed with the work that you were doing with integrating trauma and addiction in your work, and I was kind of working from a different perspective with it, but I thought, wow, this guy knows what he's doing. So when I started the podcast, I made a list of people that I definitely wanted on, and you were right on the top of the list. So I really appreciate you being here.
Well, thank you so much. I'm super glad to be here. Yeah, I was living in Central Florida when we first met. I was telling somebody the other day about some of the roadside foods that you used to be able to get in Central Florida, like boiled peanuts and like homemade bacon puffs. And I miss that. My waistline does not miss it, but yeah, Central Florida was a wild time, but that is when we first met. So yeah, things have changed.
A little bit. Well, why don't you give everyone a little introduction to you, your career, you do so, because it's going to really focus exactly on what we're going to talk about.
For sure. Yeah, so like you mentioned, I started my career in working with trauma probably about 17 years ago, and part of that included moving across the country to go work for a trauma resolution program because there wasn't a lot out there, you know? I mean, like that's one of the things that I tell people all the time. So my wife and I are big book nerds. And we just went to our used bookstore yesterday, and like they have this staff pick section, right? And you got to remember, all the staff is like 17 years old, right? They're young. This is a young, like hip used bookstore. Under the staff picks are books like The Body Keeps the Score, Waking the Tiger, Gabor Mate's like newest edition of whatever he's got out there. Back when I moved to Central Florida, Body Keeps the Score wasn't written. Nobody knew of Peter Levine unless you were like really, really deep in like the kind of stuff that you and I were doing, and even you and I were just starting to get deep in that kind of stuff. Nobody knew of Gabor Mate. He was just this kind of sleepy dude with an interesting accent that was working with drug addicts in Canada and had some kind of interesting short little articles that he was putting out. So I was like literally having to explain to parents that yes, I know your son did really well in lacrosse and I know he got into the best school, but It did impact him when his coach started molesting him when he was 14 or 15 years old, right? Like, I was having to convince people that trauma wasn't just reserved for soldiers or inescapable attack survivors, like rape victims, and that like trauma was a brain disorder that changed the way that a person's brain functioned. You know, I remember the first time I saw Bessel van der Kolk speak at a conference. I was actually speaking at that same conference. And I was terrified, right? Thankfully, like, he didn't come listen to me speak, but I was front row listening to him. And he told a room, and this is before Body Keeps the Score, he told a room of about 800 therapists that if they were just doing talk-based therapy on untreated trauma survivors, that they were wasting their clients' time. And people got, it was like British Parliament. People got up and were like, "Oh, this is bullshit," you know? Because like, when I was in grad school, the number one treatment that was being taught for treating trauma was cognitive behavioral approaches for treating trauma, mindfulness, DBT approaches for treating trauma. And people were pissed. And so when I moved out to Florida, I mean, it felt honestly in some ways like the Wild West, right? Like, we were just like, I mean, we were, I worked under an amazing human that was one of my biggest mentors named Judy Crane, and she exposed me to somatic experiencing training, internal family systems training, breathwork trainings, like all this stuff. And to be honest with you, like, I don't think we really knew what was gonna work of that stuff. It felt like sometimes you would see a client and you would try to see where they were at on that activation curve, right? That I know is a big thing in the neuroaffective model, right? And you try to be like, okay, maybe SE will be good for this. Maybe breath work will help bring a frozen person back into some sort of like healthy activation levels. And I don't mean we were like playing with it in like a reckless way. We just didn't. We knew that talk-based therapies weren't being super effective for people. And we didn't know exactly what that meant, right? So I became really interested in like, how do I give the body a process? How do I give the person a process of getting into action, when most of the time with the trauma survivors that I work with, and slowly throughout that time, my specialty became working specifically with childhood trauma and childhood sexual trauma a lot. So a lot of that was like, I would see people get really stuck in that process, right? And then as a result of that getting stuck, they would have a lot of shame, a lot of regret. You know, they'd start telling themselves the I should have, you know, I should have done something. I should have told somebody. You know, there's always this phenomenon where people reflect back on themselves when they're 5 or 6, and they give themselves a lot more adult qualities than they actually had. So they'll think that they should have been able to fight off the creepy janitor or the weird cousin or the babysitter, when the reality is, like, take a look at a 5 or 6 year old when you're walking around town. Like, they're picking their nose with a Dora the Explorer backpack, right? Like, they don't, you had no agency, right? So finding that compassion and giving them a process to kind of move through. And then I think, you know, through the years, you know, Mike, I've been trained in a lot of things. I'm kind of a therapy dork. I think you and I have that in common, right? Like, I've dove deep into Ericksonian clinical hypnosis, brain spotting, EMDR. In the last few years, it's been a lot of brain spotting because, as you know, then there becomes this nuanced thing where how you work with trauma also changes in the setting that you work in, right? So in the last 17 years, I've launched week-long trauma intensives. I had a private practice for almost a decade. I helped co-found a transitional living program for young adult men called Skyline Recovery in Bend, Oregon. I helped start a counseling practice here in Bend that is an internal family systems focused counseling practice. And the way you work with somebody with untreated childhood sexual trauma, for example, with a 60-minute session in an outpatient setting is very different than how you work with them in a retreat setting. But I want to make it really clear, you can still do really dynamic work. I think sometimes there's a myth that you have to go away to do dynamic work. You have to go to a retreat, you have to go to a trauma center. And that's not true, but you do have to be gentle, and you do have to be a lot more skillful. And so I think that's some of the biggest stuff that has evolved for me, is like learning how to be more nuanced in different settings, and definitely use more of a scalpel and not a chainsaw. Yeah.
Always think of Judith Herman's book back in the 90s, talking about safety first and then telling the story and then reintegrating. And when I heard you kind of talk about the idea that you can do that kind of really powerful work in a private practice setting, but you have to really be kind of thinking about they are going to leave your office and that they need to have everything put back together. And it's really a blending of those three kind of things. And I've done a lot of experiential work myself. And some of the most
Sure. Yeah,
powerful
me too.
work I ever did was breath work, to where I resolved stuff from my family of origin that I just thought was impossible to resolve. And so can you talk to, so our listeners are family members for the most part.
Sure.
When you say, when we say experiential work, how does that differ from talk therapy?
For sure. Oh man. Well, I think that when I think of talk therapy, I think about the importance that talk therapy plays in the integration work that is essential for trauma recovery. I want to make it really clear that if there are some families listening and things like that, and they're like, oh my gosh, you know, my am I doing the wrong thing? Like my personal therapist says that they're a CBT therapist. No, like CBT is amazing. We all use CBT. What Bessel van der Kolk was saying that I referenced earlier is that if that is your only form of trying to help a client heal their trauma, that what we find is it's not super effective. Talk-based therapies are very important in understanding a person's story. Right. So like when I am working with somebody in a trauma resolution treatment center, or they come to Skyline Recovery, or they go to one of my retreats, I want to understand their story because some people have never been witnessed before. They have never been seen or heard, and they deserve to have their story told. One of the things that happens for people is they lose their voice, or they're not believed, or they're telling themselves that nobody's going to believe me. I'm just some stupid kid. That's my, you know, and I'm continuing to kind of run with examples that I see a lot with childhood sexual trauma, but they'll tell themselves like, nobody's going to believe me. He's a beloved coach, or that's my, you know, mom's favorite aunt, or, you know, why would somebody believe some dumb kid, right? And so the voice is taken. So I want to understand the story, right? Like you take EMDR, the story and some talk-based therapy is essential for EMDR because you have to establish targets. You have to establish a clear roadmap of how you work with the person. But one of the things that I see is that people get stuck in their story. They get kind of lost in it. I think sometimes in this culture of ours, we get stuck in something that I've sort of, it's just a term that I've made up. I call it the catharsis myth, where we sometimes think, and this is some of this stems from psychoanalytic theory and history in psychology, which is this idea that we're going to lay on a couch and one day somebody's going to help us free associate this sort of like, and that was the day that I got locked in the treehouse and then I never was able to make friends, you know, and like it all comes together and it's that Goodwill Hunting moment where it's not your fault. And then he gets into the car and he goes and lives his life happy, you know. And that can happen for some people, these powerful insights that lead to immediate shifts. But most of the time, it's kind of slow, and it's a process where you kind of see and gain insight in these little clicks, these little sort of like, you know. And that to me is experiential therapy in whatever form it is. You know, I do a lot of I think probably my combination of the things that I'm doing the most right now is a lot of parts work with like psychodramatic work and advanced sculpting and sociometry and breath work. And I think one of the biggest things about that is that whether you're working with somebody in a retreat or you're working with them in an hour session, I think where people get really activated is when they get lost in their story, right? And so an example of experiential work, right, is if I know somebody's got this big secret, right? And I'm like, okay, I got 35 minutes left in a session, right? Like, I'm not gonna like start diving into this and rip them open and they gotta go to work. I might pull a chair out and put it in the middle of my big space and be like, hey, this is the thing that we're not talking about. Like, this is the secret. This is the like, I'll have some props, some blankets, some masks. Show me what this looks like. I don't even want you to talk about it. Just show me what this looks like, what this feels like. How close is this to you? Right. So they might then move that thing that they create and put it right next to them. Right. Like, what are you noticing in your body right now? Right. I just feel like I'm gonna crawl out of my skin. I feel like, you know, maybe they start crying. Okay. Yeah. Just notice that. Right. Like, don't even get them to go into the story. Right. Because the story is where a lot of people get lost. When they start talking about the story, that's when they start to get highly activated, overwhelmed. That's when they leave the office and they think, like, I can't do this shit. Like, I better just get drunk because I can't handle it. And instead, you can still do a lot of work with it not being about the story at all. Right. That's Peter Levine stuff. Right. It's not about the event. Yeah, that's NARM, right? It's not about the event, it's about the survival adaptations that arise due to early life fear. And so creating that opportunity and then giving them maybe an opportunity to use some breath work or some body movement to help move that energy out rather than just keeping it all up here. And that's what I find with a lot of my clients. They're disembodied heads, constantly analyzing, constantly trying to figure out what they should do next or what they can do to protect themselves. And that's trauma. That's hyperarousal that doesn't go away. And so that's the kind of biggest short and dirty answer that I have about it that I kind of conceptualize it as. Yeah.
Yeah, and that was a great description. And I think that's one of the things that I never even thought about the myth that you just talked about, but that it is such a myth. And so often families will come in and and I'm sure you get the same thing. What do you think we should do? And I've learned not to tell them what I think they should do. And I've really learned to much more say, what is your story?
Yeah.
And it's always changing, as you know, it's always changing, and it changes depending on how people react to it. And so I think it's really important that families begin to recognize that they have a story. It's not necessarily true. It's not even necessarily that it happened the way I remember it. I mean, I was thinking about it today, that every time I tell a story, it changes. And why did it change? And what is important about that story did I miss in the telling of the story? And that I'm missing in the telling to myself of what the story is. And so how do you help people begin to recognize, and so through that experiential lens, how do you get them to kind of reflect back then after you've done the work on how does the story change and how they see the, I always think about what caused the problem, what maintains the problem, and what solves the problem.
For sure.
And what's your process to get them to that point through the experiential thing? Like, what's your target?
For sure. Well, and I love that you touched on something really, really important, which is the way the story changes. Like, there's been some research that's been done that actually the first time somebody tells a story about a traumatic event is actually the most accurate every time after they tell the story, because that's exactly what I'm talking about. That's the catharsis myth. The more technical term in psychology is called the gestalt formation. The brain is trying to connect the dots because it wants to figure it out, right? It thinks, man, if I just could figure it out. Right? Figure out who came into my room that night. Figure out why I don't like my body, right? This is one of the reasons why we tell people to really slow down. And I know you've seen this a ton of times, Mike, in treatment, right? Like, you've got somebody that's like, why am I drinking? Why am I cutting myself? Why am I so messed up? And then they, and there's a danger sometimes. They can go into a group, right? And there's somebody there that's like, yep, I got molested, or this terrible, my dad beat me when I was nine, and then I started drinking. And that person can be like, oh man, did that happen to me? Like, I remember feeling really kind of weird. And then like, and the gestalt formation can happen, right? Like, the false memory phenomenon is very real. And it's not because somebody's lying, it's because somebody desperately wants to understand their story. They desperately believe that if they can figure out their story, then it's going to somehow release them. But actually, paradoxically, what happens is it creates more traumatic memories inside them, which from an IFS lens creates more protectors. And the more protectors one has, the more you get reinforced that the world is dangerous, right? So like, it actually like causes more survival adaptations. To get people to like to look at their story, I think that's one of the reasons why, just like you were saying, like I try to be as, when I can be, as non-directive as possible with a person's story, right? I never want to go in there and like be like, this is probably what it is, or that's probably what happened. I really want to actually try to give them as many non-narrative ways as possible to understand their story and to concretize their understanding of the story. So I'm a big art guy, right? So you're going to see a lot of like painting, drawing, masks. I love when people do things to represent their story. One of my favorite ways that I still have people tell their story of their childhood is, instead of just giving me a timeline, to write a fairy tale of their life. So like, once upon a time, this and that, because you will, you people won't get so lost in their story. They won't get lost in this whole like, and then in 1988, like this happened, and then and they, it doesn't turn into like a CSI like with string all over the place, and somebody's just completely activated by it. And I love doing things where I can like insert people into like some trance or some altered states of consciousness through things like EMDR, or through things like mild hypnosis, or through things like breath work. That is one of my favorite ways, I think, to help people integrate. That's why I started operating affordable monthly sessions in Bend and things like that. Like three quarters of them are full with my clients. I try to offer breathwork retreats for people and things like that, is because that allows people to journey within themselves in a non-narrative way. And what I tend to find is that people really seem to have like these really like non-attached experiences of their story. They're not as caught up and captivated in it, and they can kind of assess their own story a little bit more without it being this like really intellectual narrative that they have to wind their way through so much.
It's interesting that we're talking about stories today because I did a group last night with our families and our family program, and it was all about stories. And everyone was telling, they were talking about their loved ones, and I started to introduce that the concept of you're all telling stories about your loved ones, and that how much does that story change? And so just to punctuate for our listeners. This is a really big thing for them to kind of recognize that their reality is perception and what they remember and how they remember it. And where I really learned this was for me doing family therapy with highly traumatized families, how there are certain facts that are pretty consistent among everyone's story. Boy, there are some facts that are just so completely divergent. And how were you all in the same space when this happened? And so Vander Kolk calls it semantic, that it's not what happened, it's my reality of what happened, it's how I understand it. And one of the things we talked about in group last night was you seem to have a story about your loved one's addiction. How accurate is it? And that was, we all talked about that. Well, it seems to be pretty accurate. What's the implication of that story, and how does it limit you to the behaviors and to the responses that you make based on what you think is the right thing and the right story? And so, how much of your work do you actually do with family members?
I work with families a pretty fair amount. And obviously, so in 2018, along with two of my dearest friends, I launched a transitional living program called Skyline Recovery here in Bend. And it was a true grassroots effort. I mean, it was like we emptied our savings accounts and our IRAs, and we found somebody to give us a home loan. And we were like, I would literally be on parent calls while like unclogging toilets and like pulling weeds and things like that. And so for many years, I've stepped back from the day-to-day on that now, but for 5 years, I was everything to the clients, to my clients, right? And to many other clients. We all shared clients, but I was the liaison between the referral source or the consultant, the family coach. We've since done some things to just kind of like not put so much pressure on the therapist, like bring in family coaching and the family intensive and all that kind of stuff. But family work has been a big part of my career for a really, really long time. And one of the things that I love about it, and it can be really exhausting if you're not careful, is because of exactly what you talked about, Mike. It's like the story. Because there's like what's being said, right? Like you sit down with, like, let's just do a classic example, right? Parents and a child, right? You sit down and there's what they're saying, and there's what the client is saying, and then there's what's really going on. Right. There's phenomenon that I've seen since the early days of working with trauma and addiction in residential back in the day when you and I first met. And that's the phenomenon of the identified patient, right? Which is always fascinating to me. It's usually one of the first things I want to unravel, because the identified patient is not just damaging to the client, right? Where it's the whole like, hey, they're kind of the problem. If they didn't like screw up or do the shit that they did, our family system would actually be great. Maybe in this hypothetical family session we're having, there's a little sister and all this kind of stuff, right? If he just wouldn't do fentanyl, then we'd all be doing a lot better. And while there's some truth to that, right? If little Brennan over here didn't do fentanyl, things probably would be significantly better in the family system. But that immediately absolves all the parents and the little sister and everybody from like any self-exploration themselves. And that's really, really dangerous. Because when you were talking, And this idea of stories, that's how I conceptualize every family. And I also conceptualize it from a parts perspective, where I want to know, like, which parts are we dealing with here in this situation? And an example popped into my head of this client I was working with a few years ago, right? And he was somebody that came into treatment because he was drunk at college and doing college shit, was like climbing up this like rock wall outside of like the dorms or something like that, fell, sustained a TBI, everything came crashing down, right? And you know, the mother in this system was like just like her, she went from zero to he's gonna die, right? If she gave him a phone call and he was just sad at Skyline Recovery, like if he was just like, yeah, I'm having kind of a down day, she was like, he's gonna relapse, and if he relapses, he dies, right? Like, you know, dad was sort of exasperated, right? Like sort of like, I don't know what to do. So he'd sort of like hear these phone calls and like go into the other room, right? Now, it could be so easy to see this family system, right? And I'm simplifying a little bit. There are siblings and things like that, but for simplicity's sake, it could be really easy to fall into the identified patient system, right? And a lot of parents want to take us there, right? Well, of course I'm scared. This is my son. I mean, he almost died when he fell from this wall. But when we started unpacking this and really started helping the parents do their own work and helping them understand the parts that were coming forward, we were able to do work where the mom was able to identify the part of her that lost her brother in an accident when he was younger. That was a young part, a teenage part, that was absolutely convinced she should have done more. She should have told the parents brother was struggling, like all these kind of things. So that part was going to be damned if she wasn't going to do everything to keep the son alive, right? The son can feel that this isn't about him. That's what's annoying him. He can tell that this isn't even about, this is some other shit that's going on, mom. So he's rebelling, right? There's the rebel. It's like, get out of here, mom. You don't even care. This isn't about me. And dad, right? He's got his own avoidant shit, right? He's got this avoidant part that used to walk into the room and see his parents fighting and like, nope, and like turn around. And until we bring these other parts forward and actually help them realize that this is actually what's happening, you're not even that afraid of your son dying. You're trying to still save your brother. You're annoyed by your mom because what you're dealing with isn't your mother, you're dealing with her fear, and you're avoiding an opportunity here, dad, because of what you learned as a child, to come in and be like, hey, let's go for a walk, let's do something different, right? And like these different parts create the story, right? But the thing about stories is they become our truth. You know, we don't see the world as it is, we see the world as we are, as it says in the Talmud. And I've seen that to be very, very true when working with families.
My last therapist was an IFS therapist, and we did more work. And I had this whole table of protectors that I could have conversations with and begin to look at, and how it was all childhood stuff. It was all the stuff that you've been working with for years with childhood trauma, and so just for the listener again, that's Richard Schwartz's work. And internal family systems. Boy, a lot of therapists are doing it these days, so they should be able to find someone in their local area that can do that.
For sure. Yeah, and a cool resource too. I was like, look, scanning my bookshelf, seeing if I had it sitting out. But a cool resource for parents. I don't remember the name of the authors, but it's the book is called An Illustrated Guide to Parts Work, and it is like the most rudimentary like intro. It's like drawings, and it's not like for kids. It's like, but the way that they set it up is absolutely beautiful. Just to give you an idea. And to be able to start asking the question of like, I wonder what part is happening right now. I wonder why I'm like so activated by my kid. Because then I would feel for parents, right? Like there would be, you know, this pressure that happens, and I know you guys see this all the time at the Foundry and stuff like that, right? The feedback loop that can be so dangerous, where the parent can become is only safe if their kid is doing excellent. You know what I mean? Like their kid is doing it, and like, I'm sorry, parents who are listening. Your kid is going to make some dumb choices. Like, they're going to date somebody you don't like. They're going to get a sketchy job that you don't like. They're going to hang out with a friend that reminds you of another friend. They're going to have down days, right? But the paradox, the feedback loop, is then that sort of brings the protectors of the parents, right? The kid picks up on that, right? And then that brings forward their rebel, and it's a whole thing.
Well, that was one of the discussions last night, was the idea of a set of parents in the group talking about how terrified they were that their son was going to relapse. And I asked them, "Do you think your son is aware of your terror?" And they went, oh, no. And I challenged that a little bit, and I was like, maybe. Oh my gosh. And then they started putting the pieces together of what they've seen the son responding to them, that shows that he's very aware of it, and he's trying to parent them now and to take care of them. And so for this is for any of those family members that when people ask them how they're doing, they say, well, my son's doing pretty well right now, so I think I'm pretty good. This is the work that we're talking about. I think the addiction field has done it to itself, and I've about had it,
Yeah, for
with
sure.
to be honest. This idea of I went through and I looked at about 20 different treatment centers' web pages and what their description of their family program was. And it was all about you need to come and you need to support your loved one's recovery. And that's that. And that leads to exactly what you just said, that the identified client, and you're the one with the problem, and we're just here to support you. And I've really moved away from the addiction model to a chronic disease model
For sure.
that really looks at the research is very clear. So a person with a chronic disease manages that illness better when they and their family are on the same page and they're all working towards recovery together. Not necessarily on each other's recovery, but on each person's like healing. What do I need to do? And
For sure.
you made just such a good point about how often parents have their own childhood traumas and they have their own growing up in a family with addiction. And so often, I don't know if it's your experience, but it's mine that when I kind of bring that up, there's an initial defensiveness to what are you trying to say? That it's like
For sure.
that it's my fault and I'm caught. No, not at all. I'm trying to say, is it possible that maybe you have some of your own stuff to work on, could change the family, the way people interact, and the way you can support each other?
I mean, yeah, it's and I want to all the parents who are listening too, I want to make it really clear that like it is terrifying having a kid that you don't know if they're going to relapse or not. It's terrifying. I'm not sitting here and be like, just talk to your part, you know, like it is very, very hard. But I love what you just said, Mike, and I'm with you too. I'm kind of fed up with a lot of the addiction world too, with this kind of stuff. Sometimes I get pretty frustrated with the linear idea too, that like success is only linear. Kid goes to treatment and then like 45 years later he's holding your hand on your deathbed sober, you know, and it's like, and that's a successful course of treatment. Man, what a setup. What a setup for so much fear, for so much pain, for so much shame. How little it's talked about that actually, like when a client has relapses but they get honest about it, or they come back and seek treatment or go to the therapist, their chances of continued success after that like skyrocket, right? And it's like these are things, and I get it. I get it. If you're a parent that's listening and your kid uses drugs like fentanyl and things like that, it can be terrifying, right? Because you're like, but they could die, and there's risk to that. I'm not saying that there isn't, but this idea of a linear success model, right? And I'm not saying I'm in recovery myself. I'm very open about that. Abstinence is the only thing that's ever been effective for me. But all that being said, you know, like it's very unrealistic, and I think it sets everybody up, sets the client to be up. And this isn't just a parent child kind of thing. This is a husband wife husband kind of thing, you know, to where like it sets the person going through treatment up to feel a lot of shame when they can't live up to this unrealistic expectation. And it also sets the family up to just suffer really unduly, and it's really difficult. And I just think that that's some of the stuff that really also pops out to me, that makes me really sad to see.
Yeah, I had a I was working with a mom once, and she said, I can't talk to my son about relapse because he'll think that I'm condoning it. And so often it's like talking about suicide. If I talk about it, then they'll do it. And the research is pretty clear that that's just really not the case. And so,
And a lot of treatment centers take that same approach too.
oh, absolutely. And so that idea of, and again, I love the way you work. So when someone does come to you, and like what are like three things that you say to them that kind of breaks that myth of all relapse is a catastrophe, or that, and I'm with you, that chronic disease management folks see relapse as an opportunity for growth and a way to kind of learn more about the illness and about themselves. And I mean, I have my little things that I say to them, but what do you say to a family to get them to come out of that sort of old way of thinking that is.
Sure. So the idea, I'll give you three examples of what I would love. I'm going to start with the top. What I would love, what I love when I get an opportunity to do this, love, 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 is when a family comes and does like some personal retreat work with me, or maybe goes to one of the Skyline Recovery family retreats. And there's an opportunity to really, in an experiential way, because here's the thing. This goes back to your question of like, why do I like experiential versus just talking? There's research out there on experiential therapy. I didn't come with all my journals to be able to cite them accurately, but it'll talk about sometimes with talk therapy, it can take as much as 1,000 revolutions of a concept for it to sink in, which means sometimes it can take up to 1,000 times technically for a family system to sort of like get this, like, this is the Cartman triangle on a whiteboard. Like, this is what you, and this stuff is very important, you guys. I'm not saying I don't do this. I do that shit. This is psychoeducation. That's gonna be one of my answers. There's no way around it. You have to hit families with a lot of psychoeducation, a lot of compassion, a lot of like, of course you feel this way. How could you not? Like that deep understanding with psychoeducation. But the King Kong goal is rather than drawing it out, which can take so many revolutions of repetition before it actually sinks in, if you can get them to stand up in a group and psychodramatically move through something to really see it, to really feel it. Like an example is, I remember another parent that I had them like bring out all their fears, right? So they're in the middle of the circle, right? And they bring out all the fears, right? So they enroll somebody in psychodrama. You ask people to get enrolled to play different parts of your psyche, different fears that you might have, different people in your life. She enrolls, fear of relapse, fear of death, fear of failure, fear of never graduating college, fear of being a bad mother, like all this kind of stuff, right? And I then had her take a ball of string and like hold the ends of it while she passes the ball to these different parts, right? And then I asked her, like, what is this like? What does this feel like when all these voices are there? She's like, they're like swirling around in my head. And I was like, all right, I want all these parts to say these lines, right? You're a bad mother, you're this and that, and kind of swirl around her, right? It took about 12 seconds before she was completely wound up tight, right? And she had this moment where she was like, she's crying, and she's like, this is what it feels like. This is exactly what it feels like. And so I had her enroll somebody that's a support to her, and it was her husband, and he was there. And it was like, okay, I want you to come up with like one sort of like just sort of like one idea that goes against this voice, like one thing you can do, and then like your husband's gonna help you cut it. And like just this process of like her getting to feel that, and then making it really clear that like, hey, this isn't Houdini shit. You're gonna still have these problems, but this is one example where you got to see firsthand what it's like to be bound up in this way, and that you can feel that release, and that you can feel that tension, right? And so like that's like the ideal thing that I want to do, right? Is try to get somebody to that point. And then, you said the three things. Of course, a lot of psychoeducation, right? I love to psychoed parents too about the inevitability of how trauma is in all of us, generational trauma, like all the things. I mean, come on. Whether it's a husband and wife, or a wife and a husband who's navigating treatment, or parents and a child, we all got our own shit around this kind of stuff, right? Like if a husband is navigating treatment with their alcoholic wife, right? There is going to be all kinds of stuff that is going to be triggered by this experience, right? Maybe there is an enmeshed relationship with their mother, like all these kind of things, right? In parents, right? Like maybe teenage years were really hard for them. And so I tried to educate parents on like when we have kids that become the age that we were when we started to struggle, or when we like find ourselves in a relationship that reminds us of one of our parents, and now we have this young part that's like, God, I told myself I would never get into this stuff. To just help illustrate with people the power of trauma repetition, that's where I usually start, right? Is like really help people understand trauma repetition, understand that this isn't new. This goes back to Freud and the concept of repetition compulsion, a little bit of neuroscience, which is this is not your fault. You've been hardwired, your brain's been hardwired to actually find relationships like this. this. These are the relationships you know how to navigate your within. This is why you find yourself there, right? And then, I think the third thing is like, I try to hold that firm boundary, and like, you've got to do your own work. Like, you can't be the person that wants your husband or wife or your kid to go to meetings, but you don't go to Al-Anon, or you don't like go to your own therapy. I mean, I know you see this too, but like, this is anecdotal. I haven't conducted any research, but the success of a family system when everybody is doing their own healing work versus when the identified patient approach is taken, which is like, they need to go to meetings, they need to go see a therapist, they black it's day and night. You know what I mean? Like it's like all the all the biggest success stories I can think of are typically family systems that chose to heal together. It doesn't mean, I'm not saying that the parents or the husband or the wife has to do the same thing or as rigorous as the person who has a horrible addiction that got them a DUI and brought them into treatment, but just to take care of yourself too and understand your story is necess it's a prerequisite to long-term success.
Yeah, the idea that talking it through is going to solve it is a common belief. There's nothing like watching a psychodrama when you see the light bulb go on, and they're not just talking about it, they're experiencing it. You had said when you first got started, you listed a kind of a number of experiential models. You talked about sociometrics, and can you just so that our listeners can be good consumers when they're seeking experiential work, it's like you said, most people are trained in CBT, or they're, anymore it's EFT and family therapy, or Gottman, or one of these models that are not very experiential. And to a large degree, that's because of our governing bodies and evidence-based practices and all of these other things that academic institutions tend to focus on.
For sure.
So can you tell our listeners what some of those things, like what should they be asking for? Like, I know sociometrics, Tian Dayton, I know her, and she wrote, I think, a very good book on it, and others. But I'd love for you to talk a little bit about, like, what is holotropic breath work, and how does it work, and why is it helpful, and what is sociometrics, just so they can be better consumers.
For sure. I think one of the first things that I always tell parents to ask or people to ask when they're seeking out therapy is like let's say, for example, somebody wants to work with an EMDR therapist. I always coach people to be like to ask, how often do you use EMDR in your practice? Because the average consumer doesn't know that EMDR, for example, is just a 2-weekend training that like it's like the difference between like learning how to like wobble down the road on a bike versus like taking jumps. And like, in order to become really good at EMDR, like I've done hours and hours, 100 hours of advanced supervision and advanced trainings in EMDR. So not all EMDR therapists are created equally. And there's no shade to a new EMDR therapist. We all start somewhere, but it's just ask the questions, how often do you utilize this in your practice? Ask the question of, do you do experiential therapies? Do you utilize parts-based therapies? Do you ever use movement therapy in your practice? And how often, right? Sometimes when we look at psychology today, we get the cliff note version, right? So it'll just be bullet point. Oh, they said they did it. Just shoot them an email. Be a consumer. I remind therapists that I supervise all the time, hey, don't forget the customer service aspect of this work, right? Like, we are escorting people through one of the most difficult parts of their lives, and it's really, really important that we like answer these questions and make sure that we're a good fit. 'Cause there are some bad therapists out there, of course, but I think more often than not, it becomes about bad fits, right? And so, yes, like psychodramatics and sometimes sociometry is best done in a group, but it's not impossible to do individually, right? Like I do a lot of individual work like that, where I have I have these laminated pictures of masks, and I'll bring them out and have people stand on these kind of things, right? Like there's all sorts of different things that you can do. So you want to ask people, do you utilize art-based therapy in your sessions? Do you give art-based homework, right? Like, if you so like filter first by looking at their website and being like, okay, it sounds like they hit some of those things that I heard heard on that podcast with Dr. Barnes and Brennan Moore. Like, but I want to ask them, like, how often do you do this? So is this something I could expect in my course of treatment, right? And if you do a group or a retreat, ask them, like, what percentage is like group work? What percentage is individual work? What kind of models do you use? Like, any sort of good retreat should say, oh, great question. Yeah, we're going to do equine therapy one day, breath work one day. Like, where we do psychodramatic work, and this is where this person was trained. Like for example, psychodramatic training is intensive and it's in depth. I'm going to another one at Onsite in September, and it's like it takes a lot. I think lots of therapists can do gestalty type things and move people around chairs, and that's awesome. And that's another question you can ask. Okay, gestalt. So do you actually use different chair techniques and have me speak to other parts of me? That is awesome. But don't be afraid to ask people, like, what is your sort of training and experience in this kind of stuff, right? And I love that you bring up breath work, because like this is one of my favorite things to talk about. Holotropic breath work has been a huge part of my personal journey. I just did a holotropic style retreat with my dear friend Christina Huxford, who's gone through six of their week-long intensives, and she's super trained. I am nationally certified. I'm a nationally certified breath worker. I'm trained in a different style called introspective breath work. It's a cousin of holotropic breath work. And it's like the thing that I will say to people looking at breath work is, and I'm trying to be like careful. I'm trying to be diplomatic when I say this. There are some very kind of like hippie rogue breath workers out there that you might stumble on a really good one. You might stumble on a really good one. I have found some really good ones. And then there's some that I think it can be like pretty negligent. So this is my like disclaimer right here, is that breathwork practices and somatic release practices are very, very powerful. And I think there are some people out there that don't have proper training. And I think it's one thing if you want to say that, like, I'm a sound gong breath working. So and those can be really nice. Please hear me. That's fine. If you want to say that that's what you're doing and it doesn't require any training, great. But I'm starting to see more and more breath workers who don't have adequate training saying that they work with trauma and things like that. Be very careful of that, listeners, please. I think breath work is one of the most powerful modalities to help people release the shit that is inside of them, parents, clients. I think especially, like, one of the jokes I tell a lot of people is it's sober psychedelics. There's research that shows that breath work releases potentially some androgynous DMT. There's like the carbon dioxide levels that rise, it changes the alkalinity in the blood, there's excess oxygen that goes on. So much like a runner's high, right? Like breathing in this circular pattern for sustained periods of time, under the facilitation of skilled people. Because at the very beginning of this podcast, Mike, you said something I think is the most important. The first thing that I was taught with working with trauma is about the container. If you cannot contain it, do not open it. And the depth in which a client will go will be based on the container that you create. So I don't want to go to some trauma breath work with somebody not trained in it, without enough skilled facilitators to hold that space if I lose my shit. Because if I lose my shit and they can't adequately put me back together, that's re-traumatizing. Or I'm aware that they can't hold that space, so I'm just not going to go to any depth level, right? So you want to do breath work that is taught by good people. If you do a holotropic breath work session, do it with somebody that is certified in holotropic breath work or currently going through that facilitation process, right? Do it with nationally certified people, people that went to genuine breath work schools like the one that I went through. Because when you do, I think the ability that breathwork has, that breathing style combined with intense music and like somatic work, what I see is that it allows people to enter altered states of consciousness a lot of times in a safe way. So I love how many like sober people are like into breath work and utilizing it, and they find this really powerful release that is all them. It's not linked to an outside source. Psychedelic therapy is all the rage right now, and there's some interesting things that it's being used for and all that kind of stuff, but there's a lot of people that have no business doing psychedelic therapy. And this is a safe way to do that. And regularly, I hear people tell me that they had a just as powerful, if not a more powerful experience doing the breath work that I do than any psychedelic therapy that they do.
Yeah, I will say that the experience that I had doing breath work, I wouldn't want it to get any more psychedelic than that because
Yeah, for sure.
it was very real and very,
Yeah.
I'll spare everyone the story, but it's kind of my experience that a lot of people are just really afraid of experiential work because they're afraid they will fall apart, and they're afraid that they'll embarrass themselves in front of other people if it's a group process. So the breath work that I've done with different people has all been relatively similar. And so there's always a lot of music, there's always a lot of the teaching of the breathing technique. Can you walk someone through what a session with you doing breath work would look like?
For sure. So an individual and a group session is a little bit different. You know, if it's an individual session, I have a large office space with really high ceilings, and I'll have a very cozy bed set up. Yes, very loud speakers, eye masks, all these kind of things. I'll jump around just a little bit. One of the reasons the music is loud and kind of trancey and you use eye masks and things like that is because people are scared to do this kind of work, right? We live in a society, especially in American culture. I mean, literally, like we grew up in the generation where people had a front room. I don't know about you guys, but like my grandparents had a whole front room that you could see into, but nobody ever sat in it. You know what I mean? It had like floral couches for that. Like, literally, my butt never was on. I think my grandma found me out. She was like, "Get out of here!" Nobody sat there. The real living room was like the Barca loungers with the TV trays and like. So we're brought up in societies to where it's like it's about a look good. Right. So people are really afraid to lose their shit. A lot of my private practice is other therapists, and sometimes they're the hardest to get to let go in breath work and things like that because they're so used to holding it and therefore holding it in. So the loud music and the eye masks really allow a lot of anonymity because the truth is you can wail or scream or have an experience in breath work. And a lot of times people won't even be able to hear you, even though they're just a few feet from you. One of the things that I want to do if you're doing individual work with me or if you come to one of the retreats is we want to take a lot of time to like set an intention, a lot of time to like get really kind of clear about some of the different parts that have been presenting for you. So when I do individual breath work, sometimes like I'll even kind of sit down. Usually we'll sit down on the floor and just talk about the situation that's been coming up. And then like I'll bring out like different masks. Okay, this part is here. This part is here, right? And then I'll have them arrange maybe the masks and the slash the parts in relationship to how close that they are, right? Some of them might be like, man, this one's like on my face. Okay, we're gonna put it right above your head when you do this breath work, right? Like, and then to move through the breath work and to really support them. A lot of the work that I do is also somatic release work. So there's body work involved in that. And again, you said this earlier too. We live in a very litigious society, right? A lot of therapists are really freaked out about this shit. I was trained in Peter Levine's somatic experiencing, which involves touch, healthy touch, right? Like never skin to skin or anything like that. But much like a yoga instructor might do, there are times where I might like, if somebody's like this and rocking, I might sort of like do some energy work on their back and help them move and make it bigger. You know, like if somebody's like throat is really stuck, I might open up their shoulders, right? Things like that. You know, there's different things that you can do to help people move that stuff through. So it's really, really supported, including in a group process too, right? There's other facilitators who are also skilled in energy work or body work, have adequate training in these things as well, so they can help move that energy through people. And honestly, it's different strokes for different folks. You know, like I do think sometimes people are like, oh, I really want to do my work in private, like sort of by myself. Really want to encourage everybody to experience some group work at some time. Like it's so dynamic. And this retreat I just did this last weekend, I know this is a little bit woo-woo-y, but I really believe that the people that show up to the retreat with us represent different people in our lives. It's exactly the people that we're supposed to have there in that retreat. We might have somebody that's like, oh, that reminds me of this wonderful person, and I love chatting with them on the breaks. And we'll have the person over here that's like, I fucking can't stand that person. You know what I mean? And this is life, right? Like life doesn't happen in an echo chamber, and healing can't happen in an echo chamber. And the combined energy of everybody in the retreat really creates a dynamic process. I'm a big, big fan of group breath work. I think actually that's usually what hooks people with breath work at first because the energy is so intense. And so like so I think that individual breath work is very somatic, very individualized. You're very held, right? It's a ton of attention. Good group breath work still will feel really similar, but you're also playing off the energy of the entire group. And honestly, some of that insecurity and nervousness is actually a good thing. Like Fritz Perls said, fear is just excitement without the breath, right? So I think sometimes we go in and we're afraid, and then we start breathing, and it really moves things through. Because another thing that I always remind people is when we experience a traumatic event, we hold our breath, and some of us never start breathing fully after that. So many of the clients that I work with, they're just doing that fish breathing, barely breathing, right? And I think you talked about the collective trauma that families experience. I think we all start breathing that way. Right? The family start breathing that way. Everybody's just holding their breath, waiting for the shoe to drop. And so I think breath work is literally an example of helping the nervous system get reactivated in a healthy way and move that stored, trapped shit that has been being held for such a long time in a safe and powerful way. But please do it with somebody who is skilled. If they look kooky, they might be kooky. And so just ask where they've trained, this and that. Like watching a video is not enough. Going to a bunch of groups is not enough. They should have gone to a real school, a real certification. It should take at least a couple dedicated years to become a legitimate breath worker.
Yeah, that point is so interesting. That I think in my own family, how often I held my breath when I'd walk into that house, because it just one a client once said that it was so predictably unpredictable, and I thought, well, shit, that's my house. That's where I grew up, and so I think that's why I liked breath work so much, that it really did forced me to learn how to do that. And I started it very early in my career at a place in Sarasota, Florida. And I was in my 20s.
For sure.
And then I came back to it in my early 60s and had some really good experiences. So the other thing I was thinking is, and you've seen it too, where you ask a client, well, how much treatment have you had? And they'll say, well, I went to treatment at Hazleton in 1997, and you're waiting for the next, okay, what else did you do? No. Well, I mean, that's treatment, right? And the reality is that recovery isn't just about abstinence, it's about growth and it's about healing. And so for the families to understand that what you do is really something that can be done ex long term in a person's life. It is part of, like, almost like an onion unpeeling at times. And so I would urge families to not just think about, a weekend or a week or a month of treatment. And that these are the things that the people that I know that have really good recovery are doing on a regular basis
For sure.
to fine-tune their recovery and to continue that healing process. And for families as well. Like, if they could go, every family I work with, if they could go do a week with you, I think that would be the best. And
Sure.
so, I don't think there's very many people. So here's my thought is, I don't know very many people who do that. And so, is there a clearinghouse of information on people who do experiential work, or how? And I'm going to ask you to give your
Sure.
contact information, because I would hope they would contact you. But how does someone in Hollidaysburg, Pennsylvania, where I grew up, find an experiential therapist?
For sure. I mean, this is like the this is the this is one of the like most difficult questions, because it's like, yes, are there like registries? Yeah, but then they're usually registries under the obscure therapy practice that they don't know about in the first place, right? So like I know you're a NARM practitioner, but no, people don't know NARM, right? No, if you go to the NARM website, you'll get a list of all the practitioners, right? So yes, the short answer is like if anything that I've talked about here is like, dang, that sounds really interesting. You know what I mean? Oh, he mentioned hypnosis. I've always wanted to do that. Or, oh man, parts work. That sounds really cool. Yes, you can go to the Internal Family Systems website and they'll give you a list of like different therapists that might be in your area. You can, you can, this the school that I went through for breath work, the One Breath Institute, they have a really helpful tool where they show all the different breath workers that are in your area and stuff like that. I think the holotropic or the Groff Institute, I think it's what it's called. They have the same thing. So there's all these individual clearinghouses, but is there one? No, there's not. And it's really, really unfortunate. And I think that's one of the reasons why, like, I've always tried to make myself accessible. Sometimes I have to like keep boundaries because like I can't just be the clearinghouse. But I love that there are other therapists out there and other places out there that are really good about like giving resources, you know, that are really good about being like, oh man, in your area, there's this person or that person. But in some of the areas, that same deal. I grew up in Eastern Oregon. There's nothing out there, you know, so I'm not going to blow smoke up people's asses. There might not be something like that in your area. And I do think that's when resources like, you know, I'm a big fan of on-site out in Tennessee, and I'm going to start leading some retreats next year there in on-site, which I'm really excited about. And I'm a big fan of the work that they do there. I go there every year for a men's retreat. And like, so there's these little places that are out there. But like, yeah, I wish there was like this sort of like experientialtherapy.com. I think breath work is becoming much more popular. When you were doing it in your 20s, I mean, it was obscure. It was obscure 15 years ago. You know, it was driven underground, like, because they used to do breath work with psychedelics, and then, you know, when LSD left the lab and became illegal, like, they started playing with the style of breath work that we have now, right? I believe all breath work that's being done is in some way related to the holotropic movement. And I think that's good. So I think breath work is now be there's lots of breath work online. There's tons of stuff that's good breath work too. Like, I know the school that I went through, the One Breath Institute, does a lot of really good online breath work. And but again, I think it's just about being a consumer. Look where people have been trained, look where they've studied. And I'm not like an academic elitist. I actually think a lot of great healers don't have to have degrees or fancy degrees, but make sure they're well trained. You know, like all this stuff requires legitimate training and time. And then, yeah, you can always, you know, check out my website. It's brendanpatrickmoore.com. And I've got a lot of information on there too. Yeah, there's a lot of stuff out there. You do have to look for it a little bit, but I think the biggest thing is you'll find a lot of stuff, but then to just sort of use a level of scrutiny about that stuff too.
Yeah, that's really helpful, and thanks for sharing your website. And we'll put that in with the podcast so that people can contact you. And anything that we missed that you just really, and as you're thinking about it, percolating on it that you want to say?
No, I just want to say that I really appreciate just being asked to be on here. You're somebody that I just have so much respect and appreciation for, and we've just had a lot of just really cool connection points throughout our career throughout my career, and I look up to you immensely. And I think that something I would just say to the families is just if I could like impart one thing, it's like just start to be curious about some of the different parts that are involved. And I bet anybody listening knows exactly what I'm talking about, where like for no reason, right? You just suddenly start to feel yourself getting really mad over a conversation, right? You're not even usually a mad person, right? But suddenly you're just like, he doesn't even care, he doesn't even appreciate, right? What is that part, right? Is that the part of you that like felt like you like never were seen because your older brother was so much more, you know, scholastically better than you? Just be curious about it, because I think so much can be done, so much can be healed by just getting curious about parts, right? And that's the first step, right? Is like, and it's not a hard thing to just start identifying different parts, right? To start understanding different parts and just being curious about them, and just to really remember, and this is kind of a heady thing for sometimes parents, There really are no bad parts. They are all trying to protect you. Some of them just have some outdated methods. So I also hear a lot of parents that get hard on themselves, right? I get so mad. I just lose my cool, and then he doesn't want to talk to me. And it's like, no, like it's okay. Like there was a time in your life where getting mad or acting this way saved your ass. And that's good. That's a good thing. There's no bad part. And so just like, yeah, if I could just encourage parents to do anything, and just be curious about it. Just start to invite a lot of curiosity in. That's a word that in numerous times when I've had clients in like talent shows where they're imitating me and things like that, they're almost always being like, just be curious, just be curious. So like it's a word I use a lot, but like I would really challenge parents to just be kind of curious about the different parts of self. And this is not just an IFS thing. This goes back to Virginia Satir's work, and it's Jungian, it's Gestalt. Like this idea of parts has been around for a really, really long time. IFS doesn't have the game cornered on that at all. There's a lot of good different theories out there, but just be curious about it for yourself.
Now, if I had a dollar for every time I told a student or an intern to be curious, I
Yeah.
would probably be in Tahiti or somewhere at this point.
Sure. Yeah, I hear you.
So that's, I think it's great advice. Well, thank you for coming on. I always enjoy
Course.
everything you have to say, and it's been great to maintain a friendship with you over the years. And
Yes.
I appreciate it. Thanks.
Thank you.